Last week, we got to see where Solomon, the temple is built. Everything is going well in that direction. He had finished building the house. Then God came to him and spoke to him a second time after he had finished building the temple, and then he built his palace complex that would include a courthouse and place for all of his wives and all of that kind of stuff. And God came and interrupted Solomon and gave him a little reminder that, you know, God cared more about Solomon's heart and where he was at in his relationship with God than he cared anything about all of this, you know, building that he had built. We're going to talk about that a little bit more tonight, you'll see. He reminded him that if he, you know, kept God's commandments and God's statutes, then God would bless him. But the moment that he forgot, or the moment that he departed from that, then that would begin the crumbling of his life. And so we learned that Solomon is adrift. He's been drifting in his relationship with the Lord, and we talked about that last Thursday night, that drifting is a very easy thing to happen in our life as Christians, that you can just be take your eyes off of the Lord, off of that, you know, I use the analogy of being out of the beach, you know, and you can just take your eyes off of that spot, you know, on the shore. Take your eyes off of the flag or off of the lifeguard tower, or whatever it is, and before you know it, you've drifted down, you know, a half a mile down onto the beach. And it's the same thing in our Christian life. If we take our eyes off of the Lord for any period of time, you will drift. You know, God is there, he remains faithful, but it does take effort on our part to stay close to him. And so Solomon is already drifting, and we begin to see that as, you know, he got, you know, kind of challenged by God. Then he makes this little deal with Hiram, who had given Solomon tons of gold for the building project that he was doing. And then Solomon takes this guy, this great guy, and gives him some of the areas in the Galilee that obviously meant nothing to Hiram, because he was a man that was, you know, he lived on the sea coast and he had a naval ships and he had delivery ships, so he probably wanted something out onto the coast, not something inland, even though the Galilee, personally, I tell you right now, I'd take the Galilee. Even though the Mediterranean is gorgeous, the area of the Sea of Galilee is absolutely, to me, the best area around. And then we talked about some of the other things that Solomon did as he began to secure the nation. He began to build these buildings and where he was storing chariots and horses and his military up in the northern section of the northern border, the southern border, and the eastern border. And so Solomon now wisely is securing the nation. He's at peace, but yet he also knows that he is going to be a target because, I mean, the guy is absolutely amazing. And Israel, at this particular time, just to secure that nation, to make sure that they did stay at peace, he puts out this military, basically a perimeter of his military all the way around the land. So, as we began to see at the very end of chapter 9, we were talking about Solomon's ships that he had, that Hiram helped build. You know, they were down in the sea, the Red Sea, down on the north shore of the Red Sea in Eilat, which is personally another beautiful place. If I wasn't going to live in the Sea of Galilee, I think I'd take Eilat. So, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful seacoast area. And so he's got this fleet of ship with, you know, this group of men that were, you know, beginning to use the ships to go into various parts of the world and bring back all kinds of goods and all kinds of product into the nation of Israel. And that kind of sets up chapter 10. So we've all heard of the Queen of Sheba. So let's take a look and find out a little bit about what's going on with this particular lady. It says, "Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning," look at this, "the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions." And that could literally be that she came to try and give him riddles to find out, okay, just how smart is this guy? Let me give him some riddles to see if he can solve these, okay? And so she came to Jerusalem with a very great, let's see, how do we pronounce that? Retinue, I think is how it's pronounced, okay? Is that right, you guys? And with camels, I wrote it on here, how to pronounce it, and I can barely even see it. With camels that bore spices, very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So this unnamed queen, right? She's just known as the Queen of Sheba. So her name isn't Sheba. All right. She comes from an area called Sheba. And it was a very, very wealthy, very civilized area in the southern end of Saudi Arabia. In fact, if you look on a map, a current map, and you look where Yemen is, it's believed that it was probably somewhere in the area of Yemen. And so this very wealthy, very amazing spot, it was very, very civilized at that particular time. And the Queen of Sheba was taking camel loads, and she was delivering goods up into the area of Israel and into Syria, into Lebanon, and into all of these northern areas from Saudi Arabia. So now think this through. All of a sudden, she hears about this navy vessels, or these, you know, these delivery ships that belong to this great guy named King Solomon of Israel. And these ships are going to the very same areas, and they're coming up onto the Mediterranean coast, and they're delivering goods all the way up and down the coast of the Mediterranean. So now, you got a very wise, rich queen who's thinking, wait a minute, I'm doing this all by camel. Here's a guy with ships going into the same locations that I'm going to with camels. It's taken me 10 times longer to get these camels, you know, and get the goods delivered with the camels. And so I need to go meet this guy. So it was obvious that she came there for more than just to see, you know, the amazing guy, King Solomon, that she'd heard so much about. Even though, yes, that's a part of it, there was obviously some sort of a trade agreement that she wanted to try and hook up with him. Said, look, dude, I'll pay you if you start delivering my stuff so I can put my camels to rest. And so obviously, there was some sort of a deal that was happening, because I just, you know, we just read in chapter 9 where, you know, Solomon is building this fleet in and around the area of the Red Sea. So she wants to negotiate some sort of a trade agreement. And but yet, what's fascinating is how she's going to do this is absolutely amazing. Watch what happens. So she comes to him and speaks with him about all that was in her heart. Verse 3, so Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her. So when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers, and his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, that there was no more spirit in her, or literally, her breath was taken away. So let me ask you guys a quick question, okay? What is the greatest way let me ask you ladies a question. What is the greatest way for you girls to get what you want? Feed them, that's one way. Okay, what would be another way? Praise him, absolutely. So what do you think this girl just did? Wow, Solomon, you're the man. Look at what, you appeal to his ego. Listen, I was in the jewelry business when I got out of high school, right? There was this lady, I think I told you guys about her. Her name was Helen. Now, I'm going to spoil some things for you guys right now, okay? That in retail jewelry sales, they are taught, we were taught how to sell stuff to, you know, people. So they would come in and we were taught how to sell them more than what you want to spend. So you come in and we get to know, well, how much do you plan on spending? Especially if you've got a girl sitting with you, if you're buying engagement rings, right? That's the easiest, you know, piece of cake right there. So the guy says, well, you know, we were thinking about spending $1,000. Okay, great. You bring them over, you start showing them these $2,000, $3,000 rings, right? So you start laying those out on the table. So the girls are going, wow, look at this, this is beautiful. Oh, wow. And you can watch the guy notably feel uncomfortable. Well, you know, we were wanting to keep it in the $1,000 bracket. Oh, you know what? You're right. So then you leave those big ones out on the table. You walk over, you pull out the little cheapy $1,000 ones, and you show it to them and say, now look, dude, you don't want to, you want her to have something good, don't you? You don't want her to have this. Yeah, but I can't afford that. No problem. We can open up a credit card in your name. See, so you sell them, you take their $1,000, and then you put the rest on credit. Now, there was a lady in our store that could sell ice, you know, to an Eskimo. And her name was Helen. Mari knew her. I mean, this lady, now, in jewelry sales, if I started meeting up with someone that I'm thinking, I'm not going to be able to close the deal, you have someone that you turn it over. They call it a TL. You turn it over to someone who's the best. So if I'm feeling like I'm losing the deal, and you guys watch, next time you go in and you try and buy jewelry, you're going to watch this happen. I'm just messing it up for the whole thing. I'm just the magician, you know, ratting out the other magicians, right? This is why I didn't do well, because I didn't like doing this to people. I really didn't like it. And that was when I was a heathen. And so we would turn over to Helen, and I could tell you could watch her play men like a fiddle. She would start appealing to these men. Oh, you know what? What kind of work do you do? She would, oh, wow, that's an amazing. She would just appease these men's egos. And then at the same time, before they knew it, I'm showing $3,000 rings, and before they leave, they've spent five. Because Helen knew how to work men. And she was an older lady, you know, so it wasn't like she was this drop-dead gorgeous lady. She was just an older lady that knew how to appeal to a man's ego in front of his woman and make him feel like he's Superman in front of her. And then you walk out, Helen, what'd you do? Well, because I'm seeing her going to the back, getting loose stones coming out, and going, whoa, you know. And before you know it, you know, she's just taken some guy right down the, you know, put him in deep in the hock, you know. And it's all because she knew how to appeal to a man's ego by flattery and all of that. And I can tell you, it works, ladies. It works, you know. And so the Queen of Sheba shows up. She starts appealing to his ego. You know, she's probably, you know, well, show me around, Solomon. I've got some questions to ask you. And you probably know they were questions that she was like, oh, I can't believe you knew the answer to that. You're amazing. That's just simply amazing. And so, you know, she, you know, this very wealthy lady, I mean, she doesn't need any of Solomon's money. She's got plenty of her own. I'll show you that here in just a minute. What she wants is a deal to deliver her goods. It's obvious. And so, you know, watch what happens as she continues moving on. Wait just 1 minute. Let me just tell you, though, let's just look at this amazing, the wealth of King Solomon. Did you catch it? And she has seen Solomon's wisdom, the house that he built, the big entire palace area that he built. Look at even the food that he ate, how the seating of all of his servants, you know, as she looked at his just this entourage of people that he had, how his waiters were constantly serving, and even the clothes that his waiters wore, right? He had cupbearers, and those were the guys that tasted the food for the king to make sure he wasn't getting poisoned. And then he made some sort of an entryway, it says right here, that went from the palace. There was some sort of an enclosed walkway that went from the palace to the Temple Mount. And so he took her on this little, probably some sort of a bridge structure. And he takes her over and he shows her the Temple Mount. He shows her this little shortcut that he has. And when she saw all that he had, she's just like, wow. And it was probably, I mean, let's not, you know, kid ourselves. This was very, very impressive. The reason why is God said, when Solomon said, I just want wisdom to handle your people, God said, Solomon, I'm going to give you wisdom, and then I'm going to give you what you haven't asked for. I'm going to give you more money and more fame than anybody else. So it's true that Solomon did have this amazing lifestyle. He was very rich. He was very wise. And in his wisdom, he set up and he established his staff in such a way that it was an organized machine where everybody had these beautiful uniforms and all of that kind of stuff. It would have been very impressive. But the Queen of Sheba also probably just, you know, Solomon's a man with a big honking ego too, so she appeased that ego, you see? And so I wanted to draw attention to that because you need to, we're going to follow that thought here in just a few minutes, okay? And so then she says, verse 6, she said to the king, wow, it was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Now you tell me what that's all about. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw it with my own eyes. Wow, Solomon. And indeed, the half of it, or the half, was not told to me. Your wisdom and your prosperity exceed the fame of which I heard. And so, isn't that interesting? Now, I call her the doubting queen. Because think this through with me for a moment, okay? She hears, but doubts. She goes, I've heard all about your amazing wisdom. I've heard all about the words that you speak. I mean, Solomon's writing all these proverbs and everything else. He sit there and entertain people all night long. I heard about it, but I didn't believe it. I had to see with my own eyes. So could we call her the doubting queen? Sure. She doubted, you know, what was being spoken. So is it wrong to doubt until you see it with your own eyes? I don't think so. But yet, isn't it interesting? There's a guy named Thomas in the New Testament who got a bad rap because he doubted. Remember who he is? He's known as Doubting Thomas, right? What a bummer of a nickname to be stuck with for, you know, 2,000 years, right? My name's Thomas, not Doubting Thomas. But what, you know, what happened to him? It's, you can read all about him in John chapter 20. But Thomas was sitting there with the disciples, and the disciples says, Thomas, we've seen him alive. Jesus is risen from the dead. Thomas said, I doubt that. Until I see him with my own eyes, until I put my hand on the wounds, until I put my hand in his side, I'm not going to believe. So Thomas was basically saying the same thing that the Queen of Sheba was saying. She's saying, I doubt what I've heard until I see it with my own eyes. Thomas says the same thing. Everyone says, oh, doubting Thomas, man, where's your faith and all that? But what's interesting is when Jesus shows up on the scene, he enters into the room, and there Thomas is sitting, and he says, hey, Thomas, come here for a minute, dude. Thomas gets up, and Jesus doesn't look at him and say, you idiot. I can't believe you doubted. Where's your faith, you jerk? Didn't I tell you I was going to rise on the third day? How dare you doubt me? Did Jesus say those words? What did he say? Come here, Thomas. Go ahead, put your hand, touch it. Then Jesus, you know, pulls his robe apart or whatever he did, and he says, yeah, see, there's the wound. Go ahead, put your hand in there, Thomas. What did Jesus do? He answered his doubt with reality. You see? So Thomas said, then what did Thomas say? My Lord and my God. Thomas never doubted again, right? From that point forward, Thomas was a great fan. And so is it wrong for us to doubt certain issues? No, I don't think it is at all. I think it's perfectly acceptable to say, Jesus, I really need to see, you know, show me. Now, there is a certain aspect that Jesus is going to say, because he showed him, you know, his side, he showed him his hands. That much now is a done deal. But that Jesus died and rose again for the forgiveness of his sins. See, the forgiveness of his sin part had to be accepted by faith. You can doubt that all the way to the bank if you want to, but that is something that you must receive or appropriate by faith. So there are certain areas in my life where Jesus has proved himself when I have doubted. There have been times when I'm going, oh, Lord, you know, I really want to believe, but I really need you to confirm this for me, Lord. And God says, I'll confirm it for you. And he gives it to me in his word. But then there are certain aspects of the Christian life where we must appropriate. We now, based upon what God has shown us, what he has proven to us, then we can look at his character, we can look at his nature, and we can receive the rest, believing by faith that God is who he says that he is. Does that make sense? Okay. And so here, the queen comes, and she's kind of doubting, you know, just kind of like Thomas. And, you know, so she comes, she negotiates this deal. You know, she'd heard about this amazing man. She wants to see it for himself. She wants to test him. All of those things are now taking place. She sees this amazing prosperity that he has. So has God answered his, or the word that he gave to Solomon, has he now confirmed it? Solomon, I'm going to make you rich, and I'm going to spread your fame throughout all the world. Is that happening? Yes. God's been faithful to do something for Solomon that he didn't even ask for. But as I said earlier, Solomon is adrift. Okay, so I'm going to show you something. Look at verse 8. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Oh, Solomon, I mean, what an amazing job anybody on your staff must have to be able to just wait on you, to serve you, and to listen to the words of wisdom that you have to speak. Wow. Everybody must be happy in your entire, you know, in your complete staff, in your circle, everyone must be totally happy. Interesting. Hold on to that thought, okay? Then she says in verse 9, blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord has loved Israel forever. Therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. Now, I have that highlighted in my Bible because that is an amazing statement that she just made. However, let me just tell you something. Will we see the Queen of Sheba in heaven? Don't know. Because this is not necessarily a statement of faith on her part. You see, in that particular culture, just like when they were in Egypt, they worshipped all of these different gods. They had the sun god, they had the moon god, they had the god of rain, they had the god of the storm, and all of these different gods. So what she was basically saying is, blessed be the God, whoever he is that you're worshiping, the God that you're serving, because he has made you great. Now, a couple of very important things that she did say is, Solomon, this is way out of your league. There's no way that a human being could have obtained this by himself. So Solomon, your God has showed his favor upon you. So it's not necessarily that she is saying, wow, I now see that your God is the God that should be worshipped. Because when she leaves here, this is it. We never hear from her again. And so it's kind of a sad, sad thing that Solomon has brought, this woman has come, and Solomon has showed her everything that he has except for his relationship with God. Takes her up and shows her the temple. But that wasn't enough for her to come back saying, Solomon, blessed be the Lord your God who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel. Tell me who he is so that I might worship him also. You don't see that, you see? You don't see, I now want to move to the, you know, to the city of Jerusalem, or, you know, kind of like, you know, Naaman's, when he came and after he had been healed by Elijah, remember what he did? He took dirt home with him so that he could worship God on the Jewish dirt in his own country. There was a man that was converted. There was a man that got his heart changed. We don't see that about the Queen of Sheba. So sadly, because Solomon is adrift, his stuff is more important to him than his relationship with God is right now. He shows her all of his stuff, but he doesn't introduce him to his God. You see, that to me is a very sad picture. it's a clear indication, or it's a clear indicator that Solomon's off track, you see? And so, then, verse 10, she gave the king 120 talents of gold. How much is that? About 4.5 tons. 4.5 tons of gold. I could deal with a gift like that. You know what I'm saying? Now, let me just ask you guys a question. If she brought Solomon 4.5 tons of gold, do you think she's hurting for money? I don't think so. If she just brought him 4.5 tons of gold, I would think she would be a hard chick to impress. Right? But she was impressed. Okay? Look what else she gave him. Spices in great quantity and precious stones. There never again came such abundance of spices as the Queen of Sheba gave to Solomon. Also, verse 11, the ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought great quantities of almug wood and precious stones from Ophir. And the king made steps. Look at this. This is now kind of a little bit of a description of some of what the king is doing. The king made steps of the almug wood for the house of the Lord and for the king's house. Also harps and stringed instruments for the singers. There never again came such almug wood, nor has been seen to this day, or nor has the like been seen to this day. Now, King Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba all she desired. So she gave him a, you know, amazing gift, and so he gave her a bunch of stuff in return. Whatever she asked, besides what Solomon had given her according to the royal generosity, so she turned and went to her own country, she and her servants. But she went amazed, she went astounded, she went breathless, she went without a whole lot of gold. But she didn't go with a relationship with the God of the Jews, which is a sad thing. That Solomon, you know, had this golden, literally a golden opportunity. What's missing? Solomon told her everything but how to have a relationship with God. And so, amazingly enough, the Queen of Sheba is not mentioned again in the Old Testament, but she is mentioned in the New Testament. Turn with me, hold your spot here, put your bookmark. We're going to come back to Matthew chapter 12, okay? Turn to Matthew chapter 12. You guys may remember this particular instant, and I believe that Jesus, in a roundabout way, is kind of, chiding a little bit how King Solomon let this woman leave without a relationship with God. Look what it says, chapter 12, Matthew 12, about verse 38. Then some of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and he said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given it to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah." Now understand, Jesus has shown tons of signs. He's done miracles after miracle in front of these guys. And so they're just trying to get him to, you know, kind of this little dog and pony show to dance at their tune. So what is the sign of Jonah the prophet? "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Watch this. "The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And indeed, a greater than Jonah is here." So when Jonah, after spending 3 days, three nights in the belly of the fish, he gets, you know, literally vomited up onto the shore. He goes into Nineveh. He preaches a lousy little cheesy message. And the whole community, you know, repents. And he did. I mean, he walks through the city. Everyone repent because God's going to judge the land. And everyone repents from the king down, right? Because God did a move. Jesus has been preaching in the area of the Galilee, in the area of Capernaum. He has done these amazing miracles, and they're saying, "Well, do one more for us." Jesus says, no, I'll tell you the only miracle you're going to see, the only sign you're going to see is I'm going to die, I'm going to be put into the grave for 3 days, and I'll rise again. And he says, in the judgment day, the men of Nineveh are going to rise up and against you guys and say, what was wrong with you guys? Jesus did miracles. Jonah gave us a cheesy little message and we repented. Jesus did absolutely astounding miracles in front of you and no one repented. What's wrong with you people? Right? Look at this. Verse 42. The queen of the south, who is that? The queen of Sheba, will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed, a greater than Solomon is here. So even the queen of Sheba is going to say, listen, I came all the way from the southern end, the southwest corner of Saudi Arabia, on the back of a stinking camel to see Solomon. And Jesus said, she's going to rise up. Doesn't say that she is, you know, saved, obviously. He's just using her as an example. Because I am now here and I am greater than Solomon because I'm giving you an opportunity to repent. You see? And so the Queen of Sheba, he's kind of basically, he doesn't say who Solomon led to the Lord. Unfortunately, those words aren't written there. But he does use that as an example of the hardness of heart that the people had at that particular time. So back to our text, okay, back in 1 Kings. So let me ask you a question, okay? At this particular point in time, Solomon has absolutely everything and anything that a man could want. He is richer than anyone else probably on the globe. Someone just brought him a gift, you know, of 4.5 tons of gold. He lives in a house made with gold and all of that kind of stuff. She just said, man, your servants, you and your servants must be the happiest people in all the world. Hold on to that thought. The weight, verse 14, of the gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Isn't that an interesting number? 666, the number of man. That's about literally 25 tons of gold that was coming into him on a yearly basis. That's a lot of gold. Besides that, from traveling merchants, from the income of the traders, from all of the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. So Solomon was receiving, you know, money in many ways. He was receiving it as a gift. He was receiving it as taxes. He was receiving it from his ships that were going out, bringing him back money. He was also receiving it as from money that these other kings were paying him, just for Solomon not to destroy them, okay? So mafia money, kind of. And so Solomon was, you know, 25 tons of gold plus what was coming in, you know, from these other areas. So watch this, verse 16. And so King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold. 3 minas of gold went into each shield. So these are obviously smaller ones. The king put them into the house of the forest of Lebanon. Moreover, this was obviously a place where it was connected to his complex, where he put in a bunch of these different shields that are made out of gold, all right? So imagine that going into battle. You know, you're going into battle and you got a gold shield hanging off of your arm. I wonder how many guys ran away from the battle. I think I'll take this. Let's make a nice chain for my wife. And so, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps, And the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat. And two lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like this had ever been made for any other kingdom. And I'm not lying. It's Thursday night, and you guys are with me. Now, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. And all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. Silver's cheap. Don't want no stinking silver. We want gold. For the king had merchant ships at the sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory. So, you know, obviously great, beautiful things of value. Apes. It's interesting, huh? And monkeys. Now, if yours may have a little letter next to it, you see the little letter, yours may say something. If yours has a little letter next to it, look what it says, look what it refers to. Or peacocks. So instead of, I don't know how in the world they, monkey or peacock. That would be a hard one for me to get mixed up, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, it could have been, it was a translation of a Hebrew word. And, you know, so apes, monkeys, and peacocks. We'll throw peacocks in there, okay? So, you know, what would you, you know, Solomon obviously had some sort of a little zoo going on, right? So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. You know, when he describes this beautiful place with, you know, shields of gold, big shields, small shields, Solomon has monkeys and he has his, you know, he has a throne that he sits on that's made out of ivory overlaid, or probably more like inlaid with gold rather than overlaid, because, I mean, ivory is a beautiful thing to look at, so you wouldn't carve one out of ivory and then just cover it with gold. So it was probably inlaid with gold. And, you know, he's got, you know, apes, you know, he's got monkeys and peacocks. You know what? It's kind of a trip because I saw it. I don't know if you guys saw it on the news last night. They had a special thing on, I can't remember what news station it was. Sounds like Michael Jackson's Neverland. Did you guys see that? Neverland. He hasn't been there in like 2 years or something like that. And so they were showing what Neverland looked like a few years ago with all the different maintenance guys running around taking care of this place, you know, and they had the circus tent and all of the different, you know, like a little mini Disneyland, all the flowers that spelled out words that spelled out Neverland and all that. And since Michael got into his little weird trouble, now they showed it from a helicopter view, and the tent's torn, and it's, you know, got holes in it, and the weeds are growing, and rust is getting on all of the different rides, and where the flowers used to bloom, now you can't barely even read what it says, Neverland. And so it's an interesting thing that even with all the money that you can have and spend all the money that you want, you let it go for a little while, what happens? It evolves backwards, right? Okay. So, verse 20, where did I leave off? Verse 24. No, verse 23. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. So, interestingly enough, though, because Solomon is adrift, his possessions gradually surpassed his wisdom, all right? Because instead of in wisdom and in riches, it's riches and in wisdom. So what's first now? Riches. Isn't that radical? Now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear of his wisdom, which, who put it into his heart? Very good. God had put into his heart. Somewhere in Solomon's drift, he began to forget that it was God who gave this to him, that it wasn't something that he did on his own. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules, at a set rate year by year. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities. And again, those would have been outlying areas, which, you know, to protect the borders. They would have been his border patrol. In the chariot cities and with the king at Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones. And he made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores which are in the lowlands. Also, Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Kiva. The king's merchants bought them in Kiva at the current price. Now a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost about 600 shekels of silver, and a horse 150. Remember, he had so much silver he didn't even count it. So he could buy these things as much as he wanted. And thus, through their agents, they exported them to all of the kings of the Hittites and of the kings of Syria. So Solomon now is at the peak of his glory. Israel is at the peak of its glory. This is it. This is the high point of the nation of Israel. When Solomon dies, his son, you know, Rehoboam takes over. Jeroboam comes in from the north. The kingdom gets split in half. Right now, the kingdom is united under King Solomon, of which he did not unite it. This was all born to him. He didn't do anything to earn any of this. It's all a gift from God. Even the wisdom that he had was a gift from God. This guy's like Superman because God did it. So how radical that this would be, that Solomon has all of the things that any man would want. Anything that he laid his eyes upon, he got it. Whatever it was, I'll make it out of gold. Let's make a shield. Make 100 of them. Well, where are we going to get the gold? I got tons of it. Precious stones and all that kind of stuff. Solomon has this house that is amazing. All of his servants are amazing. He puts them in, you know what, I want to dress them in these fine uniforms so that they look like royalty. People coming to visit him from all over, so he is famous, he's rich, and he's famous. Queen of Sheba says, man, Solomon, you must be a happy guy. All of the people that are around you must be happy. And so at this particular point, to have that much money and that much stuff and that much fame, boy, oh boy, you would think that he would be a happy guy, wouldn't you? Well, put your bookmark there and turn to the right. Turn to the book of Ecclesiastes that Solomon wrote. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. And we'll just pick up a few little places here and there in the book of Ecclesiastes. As soon as I can get to it. Look at what it says in chapter 1. Are you guys there? Okay, it's kind of a hard one to find. Ecclesiastes, right after the book of Proverbs, or as my daughter used to call it, Problems. This is the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So that's obviously telling us that it's Solomon. He's the one delivering the message. Look what his words are. Vanity of vanities. That word vanity literally means absurdity, foolishness, emptiness, nonsense, however you want to pose it. Says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It's all meaningless. It's all emptiness. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes. But the earth abides forever, okay? So, does that sound like a happy guy? No. Turn to chapter 2, okay? I said in my heart, come, now I will test you with myrrh. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, I'm going to bring in monkeys to make me laugh, to entertain me. Madness. What does it accomplish? I searched my heart, verse 3. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine. I'll try the party life while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my great works. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards and made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools, swimming pools, from which to water the growing trees in the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers. I'll have, tons of entertainment. The delights of the sons of men and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. I was a wise guy. Look at this, verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart rejoiced in all my labor. Look what he says in verse 15. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. So does it sound like Solomon is a happy guy with all of this acquisition? Isn't that interesting? Let me just share something with you guys. The problem with Solomon is that he took his eyes off of God. Interestingly enough, in the life of David, when David got off track, he had surrounded himself with men that came and challenged him. Remember when David got off track with Bathsheba? Nathan comes in and says, David, listen, you've hired me as one of your advisors, and I'm calling you on the carpet right now. What you've done with Bathsheba is wrong. David repented. So David surrounded himself with men that would hold him accountable. Do you see anybody holding Solomon accountable? In his great wisdom, Solomon is so far off track, it's not even funny. Solomon is so far immersed himself into the luxuries of this world, it's not even funny. No one's calling him on the carpet. No one's saying, Solomon, what are you doing making gold shields out of gold? You're going to take those out to the battlefield? What are you? No, those are just for show. Queen of Sheba comes in, and he shows her all around. You can imagine all of his servants going, oh, brother, here we go again. Right? So will the possession or the obtaining of possessions, will that bring you joy? Never. Now, I know some of you are thinking, well, I'd like to try and find out just to see, you know. I want to just share something with you. I think that probably poor people or middle-class people worry more about money than rich people do. Rich people have it, and they worry about how to protect it. The poor people, the middle-class people, worry about how to get it. See? But here's what I have found. Many of you have found the same thing. Maybe we don't have gold shields hanging up in our house, but maybe, you know, there are certain things that you thought, if I could only get that, that will bring me joy. I was having a conversation just the other day with someone in this exact conversation. They have the car that they've always dreamed of. They have everything that they've dreamed of, and it's not like Solomon. This person's not rich by any means. But the truth of the matter is, stuff will never bring you joy, ever. Education is not going to bring you joy. That, you know, car that you've always dreamed of, even though I might, you know, Crystal 68 Camaro might bring me joy, okay? So it's possible, okay? But, you know, the obtaining of stuff can't bring you joy. It's just stuff. It's inanimate stuff. You understand? Even his monkeys might have brought him a temporary happiness. You get a little entertainment, you laugh about it. It's cool. Then the next day they go look at the monkeys. You can only watch them do so many things, so much gross stuff, and laugh at it only one time, right? So stuff will not bring you joy, ever. I mean, each one of us probably in this room had certain things. Oh, I can remember, man, if I could just get that. You know, I wanted this Jaguar. I get the Jaguar. I get it now. It's this nightmare of maintenance, you know, back in when I was 19 years old. And so the obtaining of things will never bring you joy. I promise you that. You go try it. It will not bring you joy. So is it wrong to have things? No. But it's wrong when things have you. You see, if you just say, oh, you know what, Lord, I would sure like to have, you know, this or that. If you bless me, God, that would be awesome to have that kind of a job or to have that, you know, motorhome or that house or whatever. And if God so blesses you with it, awesome. But don't let it possess you. And don't think that if you get it, it's going to bring you the joy that you're missing in your life. Because Romans 8 tells us that God created us with a vanity, with an emptiness that is in our life. There's an empty spot in our life. The reason that he did it is so that we might pursue after him. And so what we do, unfortunately, though, is in this attempt to try to satisfy our joylessness and the emptiness, we try to put stuff in there. Solomon tried it. I tried it. Many of you probably tried it, just in different ways. Your dream thing might have been different than my dream thing. You know, the dream job, it was kind of funny. Oh, man, I wanted to, when you're a 19-year-old kid, you know, you have a job working in with all of these wealthy people buying diamonds, you wear a suit to work, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is cool. I got the dream job. And then pretty soon I'm thinking, this is crazy. I'm spending more money on clothes than I'm making at the place, you see. And so the obtaining of things never brought me joy, and they will never, ever bring you joy because it's a thing. Things don't bring joy. You can enjoy them, but there's only one person. Well, and let me throw that at you. Your husband is not going to bring you joy. Your wife is not going to bring you joy. And it is wrong of us to put that expectation on our spouse, because God never designed them to bring you joy. Well, I got married because, you know, I had this emptiness in my life, and I wanted her to just fill that empty void in my life. And so that now I'll have the joy that I've been searching for. Wrong. You will find, in fact, that once you get married, oftentimes, you find that it is, I'm careful, I'm walking that fine line right here. You find that it's more work than you ever imagined it would be. In fact, what you will find is most of the time is when you get married, it reveals just how stinking selfish you are. Kids. Oh, well, let's have kids. That'll do it. Hello? Did kids bring you joy? For a little while. And then all of a sudden they're waking you up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Whose idea was it to have this little thing anyway? Then they kind of go through a cool stage where they're fun to have around. If you've trained them right. Although, I was out in the desert with my little brother and my dad on Tuesday. And we go out to this Mexican restaurant with my two little nephew and my niece, 4-year-old and 3-year-old, right? 4 and 3. That was not a very joyous occasion. I forgot what it was like to eat with toddlers. Or try to eat with toddlers, I should say. And that's not going to bring you joy. Kids are not going to bring you joy. It is wrong of us to put that expectation on. They're children. They're a man. They're a wife. They're a husband. They're a wife. The only person that will ever bring you joy is your relationship with Jesus Christ. That's it. You can try everything else. You can try relationship. Religion won't bring you joy. Only a relationship with God through Jesus Christ will fill the emptiness of our soul. And then we can enjoy marriage. Then we can enjoy children. Then we can enjoy the things that God will bless us with if he so chooses to do so. But even if he doesn't bless us with the stuff, we can still have a life filled with joy because it's found in a person. It's found in Jesus, you see? So for that person that maybe you've been talking to, like I was just this past week, that was, you know, trying to tell me, or at least sharing with me, I don't understand why I'm not happy. I have this, 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 and this, all of these things that I've always dreamed of. I have it now, and I'm still not happy. Well, been there, done that, you see, because a car is not going to make you, it's not going to, it might make you happy for a little while, it might make you happy every once in a while when you drive it in front down by the beach or whatever, and the girls look at you, hey, for the single guy. That's why I drive a minivan. But it's just a car, you see, it's just a car. Car is not designed to bring you joy. It's not designed to fill your emptiness. Only our relationship with Jesus. And if we drift off from there, we'll do what Solomon did. We'll start trying to fill that empty spot. Solomon could have gotten everything right. The book of Ecclesiastes would never have had to have been written if Solomon would have got his heart right with the Lord. So why did God allow all this stuff to happen in Solomon's life, people ask? To show us that stuff doesn't make you happy. Solomon is a classic example. The book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon reflecting on this, going, I had it all, and it's all emptiness. It didn't mean, it's meaningless. Later on in the book, he says, I watched rich people die, and they turned it over to their kids who didn't care about it. They squandered it away. All the hard-earned money that a father, you know, saved up for his kid, gave it to his kid. Kid squandered it away. And so, just from me to you, for those people that you're in touch with, I can tell you as we are headed towards, as we're racing towards the last days, you're going to begin to talk to people that are just like the person I was talking to this past week, that are, they have what they want and they're not happy, they're not satisfied. You get the chance to tell them, let me tell you why. I know this dude named Solomon, richest guy in the whole world, had everything, and he still wasn't happy. He wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. He tasted it all. He drank all the wine that he wanted, partied, entertainment, everything that he wanted. It never makes you happy. Why? Because it's found in a person. It's found in a relationship with Jesus. You see? You're going to get the chance to tell people that. I promise you that, you guys. We're racing towards the last days. People, Satan is in a mad dash trying to snatch people, distract people. He's even starting to snatch Christians. Distracting Christians left and right. I'm watching it happen all over the place. Christians all of a sudden walking with the Lord. Oh, yes, this is what I want. This will make me happy. And off they go. And it happens because we drift. If we're not staying close to the Lord, you start to drift and you start looking for other things to fill that emptiness because that you once had. I think for a backslidden Christian, it's even worse because you had it and then you drifted away. And then oftentimes they know better. But you're going to get the chance, I promise you. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this night. We thank you for the life of Solomon, in which, God, we see that nothing on this earth is going to bring us satisfaction. Nothing on this earth is going to give us the joy that comes only by our relationship with you. God, may you give us a chance to share that truth with those that are around us. And so, God, we commit the night to you. In Jesus' name, amen.